Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaberg Learning Consortium. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Thad Vogler, owner of Bar Agricole and True Normand in San Francisco, and your moderator for tonight's program. Our guest tonight is award-winning and best-selling author Amy Stewart. Stewart specializes in writing about horticulture and the natural world. Her first book, From the Ground Up, The Story of a First Garden, chronicled her journey to create her first real garden and was published in 2001. Since then, Stewart has written five more books, two of which, Wicked Plants and Wicked Bugs, have been adapted into traveling exhibits that appear at botanical gardens and museums all across the country. Stewart has also written for the New York Times and the Washington Post, writes a cocktail column for the North Coast Journal, and is a contributing editor at Fine Gardening Magazine. She also co-founded the popular blog Garden Rant. Stewart's latest book, The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks, explores the fascinating world of botany and booze, examining the herbs, flowers, trees, fruits, and fungi that have been used all over the world for centuries to create alcohol. Please join me in welcoming our distinguished guest, the botanical bartender herself, Miss Amy Stewart.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your beautiful book.
Oh, my pleasure.
Absolutely. Like all bartenders, I'm very arrogant about my...
I have never thought that about bartenders.
We have a very limited acumen, and we don't want to be taught anything new. So I dove into the book planning on knowing more about most of it, and I knew less about all of it. So it was a cool book to
all
read
right.
straight through.
Good.
And it's great as a resource. We keep it behind the bar at both of our places.
Oh, that's amazing.
So let's talk about it.
Okay.
What I was struck most by was the scope. It was enormous in scope. On every page, you touch on an aspect that could span all of history. How did you set about organizing it?
It was a struggle. You know, the thing about this, so the idea behind the book is to look at all the plants that we turn into alcohol, or many of them anyway. And as you know, there are all these different ways that we use plants to make alcohol. There are the plants that we actually ferment and distill to get the alcohol itself, so the ones that produce enough sugar to make alcohol. And then there's all the plants that get added at the distillery or the brewery or even the winery to change the flavor before it goes into the bottle. And then there are the things that you might add behind the bar to make a drink, right? So I had those ideas as these will be the categories. But then the question was really where to stop, because it turns out that if there is a fruit anywhere on the planet that produces sugar, someone has made alcohol out of it. And if there is a leaf or a flower or a seed that has any kind of flavor, good or bad, someone has dropped it into some booze to say, let's see what we can make of this. So it was hard to narrow it down. And then some of these plants have such vast and interesting and complicated histories, and I had to figure out how to just focus on the alcohol part of it. So if we're going to talk about corn or grapes or even agave, like, there's a lot of stuff you got to ignore to stay focused on the booze part of that plant story, you know? It's tricky.
And super interesting.
Yeah.
I should confess, we've been talking backstage for a half hour and just having an awesome conversation. I'm sorry we had to interrupt it and come out here.
They said they wanted us to sit out here, so yeah. We did that.
One of the things that struck me about the book that we were chatting about a moment ago was how much it had to do with natural selection and how many stories of death there were, and how from human beings dying from accidentally eating things to natural selection in the plant world.
Right.
It seems like a theme that you noticed. I was curious.
Well, I have to say, as the author of a book on poisonous plants, I was very alarmed at the possibility of any plant that might be mildly toxic being used to make alcohol. And my husband actually told me that I had put too many warnings in there about poisonous plants. But it just made me, I thought, people are going to read this book and they're going to run right out and start doing stuff. You know, right now, people are making bitters out of just everything imaginable. And there are, of course, a lot of poisonous plants out there. And you soak them in alcohol, and alcohol is a solvent. And it extracts the active ingredients out of whatever is soaking in it. So I was wanting to be very careful about that. And there are definitely plants that we've used as medicine over time that medicine gets turned into a cocktail ingredient after a while, right? That's sort of been the journey that some of these plants have taken. And they definitely had some potent qualities. But natural selection, too. So grapes, that was a real challenge for me writing about grapes. Like, what do I say that hasn't already been said about grapes? There are so many books about wine and brandy already out there. And I thought it would be interesting to focus on the North American native grapes. Because you notice we have native grapevines in North America, but nobody makes wine out of them. So why is that? And so I remember this trip I had taken to Minnesota. I was speaking at a botanical garden or a university or something, and the whole botany department was going to take me out to dinner. And they said, oh, at dinner tonight, we're going to eat at this restaurant that does all local food, and you're going to get to drink some of our local Minnesota wine tonight that we're making. And I'm from California, right? So I'm thinking, oh, how nice. Okay. They were very proud of it. It turns out what they have done is they have been crossbreeding these hardy, frost-tolerant, you know, they can get through a winter freeze, these vines, and they've been crossbreeding them with some French varieties and making some beautiful wine out of it. This was a fantastic, delightful wine. So I asked the guy who's been working on these grapevines why it is that North American grapes are so hard to get wine out of. And it turns out that in North America, in Europe, our grapes were selected by people. Thousands and thousands of years of human selection. Somebody walks along, they pick a fruit, they eat the fruit, they help move the seeds around just like birds do. They select, they choose. Even before they understood what selection was, we were inadvertently doing it as early humans. So the grapes that were growing in Europe were just fantastic because of just eons of human selection. But in North America, it was birds that did the selecting. Not humans. So our grapes in North America tend to be small, so a bird can get it in its beak, and blue. They can see blue. They like blue. Flavor was much less of a concern. So anyway, I just thought it was like that was one little part of the story that I thought I could really talk about that maybe no one else had.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's like a such a phenomenal series of accidents that lead
exactly.
us to
that's right.
to now. And right. I was struck by how slowly the history of booze moves, like fermentation we stumble onto accidentally, yes. and we stick with that for a long time.
Right, like 800 AD or so was when we finally figured out. So before 800 AD, no one had had a hard drink, a stiff drink. So you can imagine how desperate people were by then. I mean, think about everything that had happened, right? They're like, oh. Beer's just not going to cut it. We're going into the dark ages here, folks.
And so then, earliest estimate of when distilling begins, what did you find?
Well, I mean, 800 AD is about mm-hmm. the number. It looks like it was actually probably an Arab innovation that moved into Europe. I mean, we had to know about metal. You know, we had to be able to make a thing out of metal where we could boil some water in, basically. So the technology had to get there.
And we were talking backstage also about how much, and something that interests me, trying to get people to perceive spirits as food rather than as name brands is a big challenge. And really, spirits feature prominently, you've talked about, in agriculture, a way of maximizing agriculture.
Well, yeah. I think sometimes we walk into a bar or a liquor store and you look at all these bottles and it doesn't immediately click that it's all plants. It's nothing but bottled plant matter. That's all it is. Apart from the really cheap stuff, like the stuff that you will never see at his bar, the artificially flavored, apart from that stuff, everything in all those bottles behind the bar are just plants. There's no chemical additives. There's nothing else going on. And so, yeah, you know, a lot of the history of how we developed the really fantastic spirits that we did had to do with needing to use up the crop. So apples are a great example. Especially in today's market, you know, apples have to be a certain size and they have to look perfect. And if Safeway is going to order apples from a farm, they're going to have specifications about exactly how big it can be and no blemishes and all of that. Well, what do you do with your oddly sized, misshapen, the apples with little bug bites out of them or little blemishes? You grind that up and make cider out of it or make calvados out of it, and it's fantastic. So, like, I interviewed a potato vodka distiller who only wants to buy the potatoes that the farmers can't use for food. The odd size, the blemishes, just give me all that stuff that you can't sell and let me make vodka out of that. And corn too, bourbon. You know, it's so funny what happened in Kentucky is that you could stake a claim on some land if you would plant a field of something. They didn't say corn, but just something. Turns out corn is the easiest because you don't have to clear the stumps. So you can cut down the trees and plant it among the stumps, and it was easy. A lot of people were growing corn, so you had a guy growing corn. Next to him, another 80 acres, corn next to that. So who are you going to sell that stuff to, right? There's no real market. They were just planting a lot of it with no way to get it anywhere except by horse. Well, if you distill it, then rather than have giant bushels of corn to get to market, you have these nice little bottles, right, that are just easier to deal with, easier to transport, get a higher price, and thus bourbon was born. Thank goodness.
Yeah. Absolutely. Woo. Yeah, Calvados is one of my favorite spirits also.
Me too.
Go to Normandy, or the last 3 years I've been to Normandy each winter.
Yes. And you should tell them, if they don't know, what true Normand, I mean, tell them what that means.
Oh, sure. Yeah. True Normand is, which is the name of the bar that was most recently opened, is the practice of taking a shot of brandy, often Calvados, which is the heirloom apple brandy of Normandy in northern France, to settle the stomach, to stimulate conversation, to get you ready to eat more. And we first encountered it. We were at this property called Camus, and in Normandy they were populated by Vikings, so these were French people that defied the stereotype of French people. They're a massive, like, guys, and we grilling a huge ribeye, and we'd already eaten so much, and they said, let's do the True Normand, and was confused, and they poured massive shots of Calvados, and the night went on. But anyway, we miraculously ate more. But in talking about Calvados in your book, you talked about all of these varieties of apple that aren't, that as you just did, that don't taste great on their own. And that seems like a big dynamic in the book, is finding things that don't taste great, or may even not be safe to eat, but the process of fermentation or distillation make them possible.
I mean, they become wonderful.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that true with cognac as well, that those grape varieties don't make particularly good wine, but it turns out that you distill them? And I think, you know, sort of the story, and this is actually one little bit of history that I would like to have researched more, but kind of I think people's general understanding of what happened is that the Dutch showed up, and here are the French making, you know, wine in the cognac region, and it really wasn't very good. And the Dutch were sort of unimpressed. And they said, I know what let's do. Let's park a still here right in the harbor, and let's distill this stuff so we have less of it to deal with, and we'll take that. Thank you very much. And, you know, turned out to be a better use of the stuff.
One thing that's cool about France is that they have appellations that kinds of spirits are protected, like kinds of wine. And so in that culture, you really, like, they insist on seeing booze as agriculture. And I was curious, like, what other cultures in all of your research did you encounter that have similar priorities? Or,
well, you know, so this was one thing I really tried to do, was to be very global, to not just focus on North America and Europe, which in the drinking world, that's where all the attention goes, right? But when you look worldwide, you get a very different picture. So Africa, I thought, was really amazing. Hmm. You don't really think about Africa when you think about our drinking traditions, but it turns out that sorghum is a very big grain in Africa. It's very drought tolerant. It's really tough. It's just a survivor. And so in times of famine, there's always some sorghum to eat. And so they make a homemade beer, this cloudy, opaque, homemade stuff. It's a little sour. You know, it's actively fermenting. Like, you can't bottle it because it would explode, you know. Like, it's still fermenting. They put them in these cartons, like these sort of milk cartons, and there's a vent for the CO2 to get out because it's fermenting. But that's a great example of, you know, this really just close connection between what we're eating and what we're drinking. Bananas too, you know, in Uganda there are these beer bananas. So there's bananas that you eat and then there's beer bananas. And the beer bananas are useful to grow because you can make, again, it's like a home brew kind of beer, and you can sell it there on the road next to your farm and add a little value to what you're doing, get something extra out of it. So yeah, it's always been very closely tied to the farm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So are all botanists as fun as you are?
Well, I'm not trained as a botanist. I mean, I have a real interest in the uh-huh. plant world, and I've been writing about botanical sciences for a long time. But, you know, actually, talking to botanists was really the fun part of this book, because one of the gaps, there's this big gap between the cocktail world and the botany world. They don't really talk to each other. So I would call a scientist who specializes in gentian, for instance, which is this herb that grows in the Swiss Alps that's got a wonderful bitter flavor. If you've had Campari, you've had gentian. Delightful bitter plant. And she knows so much about how this plant has been used to make spirits and to make medicine. But no one in the cocktail world has ever really talked to her. So she was very happy to get my call because, you know, she's interested in this stuff, but she lives in this kind of academic community.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always trying to invite these people. Do you want to come talk to some bartenders at this conference in New Orleans? I really think they'd like to hear from you.
You go to Tales of the Cocktail regularly?
Yeah, I have been. Try to recruit them.
Yeah, I was struck in reading the book that it was like Herculean to get from the plant kingdom into the bottle,
uh-huh.
and then, as though that weren't enough, you wanted to get from the bottle into the glass. You must really love cocktails.
I do, yeah. I mean, yeah, I had a real interest in cocktails going into all of this. Mm-hmm. It was an easy book to talk myself into writing. Like, oh, darn, you know. I wrote a book about earthworms. I wrote a book about venomous insects, and no one offered to help with the research on those books. But suddenly it's time to go to France and tool around at distilleries for 3 weeks, and everybody wants to carry my suitcase and help out with that.
Interesting.
But, yeah, no. And you know, I think knowing a little of the science, I mean, science in very small doses, I think can be really helpful. So a good example are there are all these spirits that are licorice flavored, so absinthe, pastis, all of those have a very similar quality, which is that the flavorful, oily molecules from the plants that end up in the spirit are very evenly distributed throughout the alcohol until you add water. And when you add water, they become kind of unstable and they clump together. So this is very much like if you have soup and there's a little butter or olive oil and it clumps together on top and you can see it. And so you can see it, so it gets cloudy all of a sudden because you can see it, right? They've clumped together into these larger groups, and you can taste it better as a result. So I think, like, you understand a little bit of that science, and it helps you to understand why we always add a little water or ice to a drink, because we can get more out of the flavor that way. So I just like the way knowing just a tiny bit about the plants and what goes on when they come into contact with alcohol, how that translates to what we drink.
No, it was really cool. I could tell you have pretty evolved taste in cocktails. I mean, cocktails are very simple, like, flavor machines. They take sweet, sour, bitter,
uh-huh.
right, salt. They're
right.
Basically, sweet, sour, bitter are the three flavors you're working with cocktails.
Yeah.
You find balance there, and then what you build on that with is aromatics.
Yeah.
And you seem very fascinated with aromatics.
Right. Yeah, that's really what plants deliver. I mean, they've been doing it with perfume. I think that's another very similar thing, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, it's all about these. And the plants are producing the aromatics for different reasons. They're trying to attract pollinators, or they're trying to ward off insects. You know, they're doing something completely different. They're not thinking about us. They're not thinking about gin at all. But we're very lucky that they're out there doing all of that complex chemistry.
Can you remember a cocktail that really sort of started the ball rolling? Like, when did you, was there a moment or a period of time when you fell in love with cocktails?
Well, you know, I was living in the Bay Area when this sort of modern cocktail movement got started. I mean, I don't know what you would say. When people ask me how this sort of got started with cocktails, what I say is there were a group of people in New York who were really interested in history and pre-prohibition and ingredients that aren't available anymore. And then on the West Coast, we became very interested in local seasonal food, which got into our drinks. And those two things went on a date, and their love child was the modern cocktail, you know. I mean, suddenly we're drinking these drinks that have these really interesting 150-year-old formulas in them, but also have these really fresh, obscure currants that some farmer in, you know, Mendocino is growing. And those things sort of came together to make what we're drinking now.
Yeah, that's very well described.
Yeah,
it's perfectly described. And like you say, so much of it is, excavating what's old and before the Industrial Revolution, how things were being made.
Yeah,
obviously is really fashionable. But do you have a first drink or?
Well, I would say that I was drinking gin. So there's just such endless variety and interesting things that have been going on with gin on the West Coast for 15, 20 years even. And so, you know, visiting bars like yours in the Bay Area and then making pilgrimages out to New York where, still today, Maya Huel is probably my favorite place to stop. It's all agave-based spirits, and they just do remarkable things with mezcal and tequila out there. So, you know, as those places started opening up, I was trolling through them.
That's a great. It was frustrating as a Californian to see New Yorkers nail an agave bar.
Oh man, did he ever? Man, yeah. Good work.
You write really beautifully about agave. There's a lot that's been written about it, and was very fresh and exciting.
Yeah, I love that plant. It's such an unlikely source of alcohol. I mean, it's definitely one of those plants where you go, who was the first person who thought they would really? Because, when I go around and have a slideshow, I show people this picture of someone essentially trying to tap an agave plant for its sap, which is how you make this drink called pulque, which is kind of like beer out of agave sap. And you have to crawl inside this thing and do battle with it. And it's as tall as you are, and it has fangs, you know? I mean, it's a monster of a plant. And to think of people hundreds and even thousands of years ago, I mean, again, they had to really need a drink, right? They were like, we are doing this.
So I have some questions from the audience,
which
I'll treat you to at least one. What's the worst is underlined as a point of emphasis, drink you've ever had?
All right, so should we exclude just like bad drinks made at like chain restaurants that shall not be named?
That's a good
that.
Idea.
Okay, because we could be here all night with
that.
Yeah,
that's a good idea.
I'll tell you what was a really hard sell for me. So I mentioned sorghum earlier, and I'm kind of in love with sorghum. It's this very unglamorous, unloved grain, and I'm sort of its little champion. It's like the uncool kid at the grain party, and so I kind of love it. So I was very interested in Moutai, which they make in China, and it's this kind of white lightning, sort of white moonshine-like spirit made out of sorghum. It's what Nixon drank on his trip to China, and so Al Haig had gone out ahead of time to do a little reconnaissance and sent back a telegram saying, under no circumstances is the president to drink after any toast. But the president matched his host drink for drink and drank that stuff. And Dan Rather said it tasted like liquid razor blades. He was there for that trip. But I was interested in it, and I knew that there's a high-end market for it, like scotches, you know, and there had been speculation and it had been run up. So I got a bottle that was sort of a mid-priced bottle, and it was rough. It was hard to drink, but I thought, well, I'm drinking the wrong stuff. So then I got a hold of somebody poured me a little of sort of the $400 version. And I gotta say, I mean, no disrespect to the Chinese, who are very proud of their national spirit, but I got to take the bottle home, and I have never offered it to a guest.
That was one of my favorite lines of the book, Dan Rather, tastes like liquid.
Yes.
Razor blades. Can you describe what liquid razor blades taste like?
The funny thing about this spirit is they tell you to just drink it right down. Don't leave it in your mouth. So that's a red flag right there. Usually a distiller who is rightfully proud of their product will, if they think you don't know any better, will tell you to sip it. You know, you don't slam the stuff down, you enjoy it. So I thought, okay, well, that's a little bit of a problem. I mean, it is, you know, it's like a mouthful of gasoline, kind of. I mean, it's just all alcohol. It's pretty high proof, and it has a lot of kind of, I would say, banana flavors and these sort of odd, these tropical fruit sort of esters that, but not in a good way, really. So just a, like they've gone off just a little bit.
Yeah, banana esters are often a bad sign.
Yeah.
What are those? Or do you know?
Well, I mean, they come out, you know, it's a very complicated chemical process that alcohol goes through. So, you know, the fermentation process, basically what you're doing is you're taking sugar and you're feeding it to yeast, and yeast, like all living organisms, generate waste products after they eat, only their waste happens to be way more interesting than ours. I mean, I'm glad we can't do this, because that would be weird. I don't want to know what the world would be like if that were true. Because they produce alcohol. That is their waste product. So but a lot of other very complex things go on. They don't just produce pure alcohol. So there's all these very complicated chemical reactions that happen during fermentation, and some of that ends up in the distillation process and some of it doesn't. Distillers have to be very good at extracting just the part of the alcohol that we want to drink and leaving the poisons behind, because there's a lot of, well, I mean, it's all poison, let's be honest here, but in moderation. But there are a lot of pretty toxic compounds that come out of the distillation process. So I think those flavors can be a red flag that maybe it's not quite as clean a spirit as we would like to believe.
Another question from the audience. How many plants do you grow for bartending purposes? It's a two-parter. And any advice for those of us who are the opposite of a green thumb?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I have a cocktail garden. Of course, you know I had to do this, right? I had to, like, plan a special little garden for the book. And so I grow maybe 40 or so different things, most of them herbs that are easy to grow and that everyone can do, but also some more unusual things. I live in Humboldt County, so berries do very well up there, and I'm growing black currants, which the French used to make cassis, very unusual fruit that we don't grow a lot in the United States, so I'm excited about that. And elderflowers, so maybe someday I'll have enough at one time to do my own elderflower liqueur. Right now I only get two or three clusters of flowers at once, but and some fruit, you know, some berries and blueberries and things like that. And, you know, if you're not much of a gardener, the thing is, it's hard to mess up just herbs. And it is nice to be able to run right outside and grab a little mint or a little, you know, even something. I often recommend that if people are going to go to the trouble to grow something for cocktails, grow something that you can't get at the farmer's market or the grocery store. And a good example might be something like scented geranium, which come in all kinds of flavors, including rose. There's an incredible rose scented geranium. And those things are so great in gin and vodka drinks and really unusual, and you can't just run out to the grocery store and pick them up. So I think it's lemon verbena, same way, great in cocktails because it's a clean citrus flavor but without the acid of citrus juice. So if you're looking for that, then, you know, that's something you can do.
I was curious, when we were talking backstage, you banged out the components of kümmel, which
kümmel.
A lot of people can. But I was curious, there are lots of forgotten, lost ingredients, and in bartender circles there are attempts to recreate them or longing that someone would. Do you have something that you wish would be recreated, or was there something you encountered word of but never got to taste?
You know, I think this need, and this is a thing, so this is really a thing in cocktail culture, is to find these forgotten formulas and to bring them back. And I understand the impulse, like it's this little bit of forgotten history and it's inaccessible to us, but we can maybe make it again. But then again, we have never had better drinks than we have today. There was no golden age when people were drinking better stuff. The whole reason a lot of those plants got added to alcohol in the first place was just to try to cover up really bad alcohol, just to try to make it palatable. Or they were doing it for medicine. I mean, they were doing it because they thought this tree bark would treat malaria. And is that really a reason why we need it again in our high-end cocktails? I don't really know, you know? I mean, I love seeing people working on it. People are always trying to resurrect the formula for some long-lost bitters or vermouth. And I love to see people go after it. But at the end of the day, if it doesn't taste good now... And hey, it probably didn't taste good then either. So, what are we doing?
There may be a reason they don't exist.
Yeah.
Good question from the audience. They're all good questions, but a question from the audience that seems related. Does mass production of spirits and alcoholic beverages risk the variety of flavors and other characteristics of great beverage?
You know, I think that really depends. It is a good question. And I think sometimes mass production, you can get some sort of generic, dull, not particularly tasty. I mean, I'm thinking about tequila, for instance. There's some mass-produced tequila that's not particularly delightful. But then again, look at gin. I mean, Beefeater. I think Beefeater's a great gin. There's always some Beefeater in my house. And it's a ubiquitous brand. Maker's Mark. It's a bourbon that's everywhere. I'm sure we don't have to walk two blocks to find a bottle of Maker's Mark somewhere. It's a very nice bourbon. So I don't know that mass produce has to mean that it's not very good, but it is true that sometimes it does. And also, some liquor producers are going for, you know, a different market. I mean, I think, unfortunately, with vodka, we've seen just horrific flavored vodkas. I've often wanted to do like an Instagram account or something of all the awful flavored, you know, the marshmallow flavored vodkas and stuff I see in grocery stores. What a nightmare.
Yeah, I agree. I think especially in making cocktails where you're combining them with the spirits with a number of other things, a relatively large production spirit is often the norm. And yeah, gin is very widely produced, American whiskey.
Yeah.
Absolutely. They're sort of, for cocktails, it's almost, especially if you're running a bar, it's almost unavoidable.
Right.
Here's a fun question. Someone must know that you live in Humboldt. Can marijuana be used to make alcoholic drinks? If so, what kind of drinks?
If so, and, you know, this actually gets to my history as someone who's written about poisonous plants. So what we often don't know, and I mean just you and I, just ordinary people, is we often don't know the exact level of a particular compound that might be in a plant. Plants move molecules around throughout the day. They move them around the plant. It changes with temperature. So the relative strength of a plant, let's take marijuana as an example, is hard for us to know. And when you put it into alcohol, you're doing a very crude, unsophisticated, unrefined extraction. You're just saying, whatever is soluble in this alcohol, I'll take it. I don't know what it is, but I'll just have it, right? And so that's why, for instance, you cannot behind the bar soak some juniper and some other things in a clear spirit and get a gin that tastes like what they can do with their fancy equipment at a distillery, right? Because just soaking something in alcohol is too crude. It's just going to grab everything, the good and the bad. So I feel the need to caution people about extracting marijuana into anything, whether it's alcohol or food, because there's a fat-soluble thing with pot as well, and we don't know the dosages very well. So I think we need good science is what we need. We need good above board science with all that, and we don't have it yet.
Mm-hmm. Let me pause to remind our listeners, this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking with Amy Stewart, author of The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. I am Thad Vogler, owner of Bar Agricole and True Normand in San Francisco, and your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. Let's resume with another question from the audience. What's the difference, and a good question that we should definitely touch on, what's the difference between distillation and fermentation? What plants turn into what alcohols?
Oh, yeah. Okay, good. So what happens, the way that fermentation works is that you just take you take grapes, or you take, apples or sugarcane even, or grains that have starch, which becomes sugar, and in a sort of big liquidy vat, you feed that to yeast, and the yeast eat it, and they excrete this alcohol. But the yeast cannot live in their own waste products for very long. So at some point, the alcohol level gets high enough, like 10, 15% somewhere, where the yeast start to die off. And so that is why nobody ever had hard alcohol back in the day when all we could do was ferment. So that's how wine and beer is made, basically. You just take these sugars, you feed it to yeast, you bottle it. I mean, it's a little more complicated than that, but that's pretty much the deal. If you want something that's more like 40% alcohol, what you have to do is boil it. And everything has its own boiling point, right? So things start to lift out of the solution when they hit their boiling point. And ethyl alcohol has a particular boiling point. So when the ethyl alcohol reaches its boiling point, it lifts out in steam, in the form of steam. And you know how if you have a pot on the stove and it's boiling and you put a lid on the pot, the steam rises up, and when it hits the lid, it turns back into liquid? It condenses. So that's what happens in the still, is it goes from being steam back to being a liquid, just the alcohol, and they siphon that off, and that's distillation. So when it comes out of the still, it might be a higher proof, and then it gets watered back down to something like 40% alcohol to be bottled for you to take home. So they sort of get it back to where it's going to be. But it can be higher, quite a bit higher than that coming out of the still. And in terms of what gets made into what, so grapes get made into, all kinds of fruit can be made into something called brandy. Vodka can be made from anything. One of the best parties I had while researching this book was a vodka tasting party, because I ended up with 20 some odd bottles made from everything you can make vodka from. We had a beautiful apple vodka, we had a nice grape vodka, every different grain. We had a honey vodka, one made from maple syrup, even one from milk. There's a milk distilled vodka that they do in Vermont. So we had 20 or so of them out there, and people could go and do a little taste test. People come to my parties. I don't have a lot of, I'm not a great hostess, I'm not a good cook, nothing like that, but I send out an email and man, everybody shows up. They're like, we're just going to get chips and salsa, but the drinks are going to be great.
So speaking of entertaining, do you have a go-to cocktail when you have a party, or?
Well, what I've been trying to do when I have a party is to clear out my inventory a little bit. the thing is, when I was working on The Drunken Botanist, my liquor tab was a tax write-off. Right? I mean, I was obligated to try all this stuff. If I was going to write about it in the book, I had to have a... So there were no breaks on my spending. It was a little dangerous. I had to build shelving in the house. I had boxes. I'm sure you've been to people's houses where they just have boxes. Because wine, you can lay it down. But with a spirit, once it's open, you got to keep it standing up. So I had to build racks, earthquake-braced racks for my collection. So when I have a party, usually we make a drink or two that's the theme. And it's because, we've got a lot of rum and we need to move this rum or whatever. The next one I want to do, though, is vermouth. And you live in a world where vermouth is very well appreciated, but I think a lot of people still don't understand what wonderful, fantastic vermouths are out there and how drinkable they are on their own. So I want to have everybody over and make them drink vermouth and watch them be amazed. All these aromatized wines. So the whole idea, it used to be, even the Greeks and Romans were doing this. You'd have wine and you'd add some plants to it, maybe to make medicine, maybe just to preserve it. Maybe to improve the flavor, because the wine wasn't very good. So plants soaked in wine, that's an ancient thing. Vermouth is a very old drink, but delightful, very drinkable on its own. I always tell people, if you have a bottle of vermouth at home that has been open for 6 months or 6 years collecting dust, you need to pour that out tonight. That is no longer a cocktail ingredient. good vermouth, you got to drink it up within like maybe a month. You got to keep it in the fridge because it's wine. So the bottom of my fridge is just, there's just 8 bottles of great stuff. And you got to work, you got to apply yourself. Like every evening, you need to make it. You do. You have to make an effort and get through it. So I got to have a party and get through.
What a work ethic you have.
I know. I know. When we were, so the recipes in the book are very much just classic cocktails because it was, you know, I was not trying to reinvent the mm-hmm. wheel with drinks. I was just trying to say, have you ever thought about all the different plants in a Manhattan? Here's a Manhattan. Let's look at all those plants. But I did have to test them all. Writing the book, so we went through one round of testing, and then the copy editors got hold of it and kind of re-moved things around and reformatted the recipes so they were just in the standard way the publisher wanted them. And so I had to print them out again and keep them in the kitchen. So my husband would come home from work every night, and I would be like, all right, we have 60 recipes here, and I need these checked off. You need to make one and sign off on it that it's right. So there was a lot of testing involved.
So what's your Manhattan of choice?
Oh, well, I mean, Punti Mace, mm-hmm. I like a lot for the vermouth. That is delightful. Although I've been playing around with the Cokie Americano, the red Cokie Americano, which is my favorite thing in the world. And kind of just whatever bourbon we have. You know, you can get so fancy with bourbons, and it just got to be too much for me after a while. And I was like, I'm done being a bourbon snob. I'm over it.
Yeah,
so,
me too.
So...
No, we do Wild Turkey and Cokie Americano.
Oh, Cokie, I bet that's Cokie delightful. Yeah. I bet that's really good.
Great minds think alike.
Yep.
speaking of great minds, one in our audience asks, how many recipes are in the book, and did any recipes not make the cut?
Oh, there are so many recipes that didn't make the cut. There are 60 or so in the book, and really what I was trying to do was to say, what is a cocktail that best expresses this plant? So what is the best expression of corn in the glass? It's obviously got to be bourbon. So they were really just chosen for that reason. And also just to say, these are the drinks. They're common drinks. They're simple drinks. Anyone should be able to make these. There's not a lot of elaborate ingredients in them. You know, our cocktails have gotten very fancy, and I love to go out and have a fancy drink, but there will be no more than 3 or 4 ingredients in my drinks at home. So... So they were not terribly elaborate, and the book had to be 400 pages. That was my absolute limit. So I put a bunch more on my website. If you guys go, there are tons more recipes. Every time I think of something new, I put it up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another question. Have you worked at all with medicinal botany? Are there parallels between the two practices?
Oh, well, yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm very interested in plants as medicine. And because I've written both about poisons and alcohol, there's so much, there's just so much bleed over there. I mean, chartreuse, for instance, is a very complex herbal liqueur that got its start as medicine. And you add a little sugar to it so that your patients will be more likely to drink it, and then it's not very long before you're putting a little bit of your medicine into your brandy every night after dinner, and pretty soon the cocktail is born. So yeah, there are a lot of similarities and parallels there, and I'm fascinated with it.
Mm-hmm.
What else we got?
This is one, I wonder if you can answer this. Mm. Is root beer the same as sarsaparilla?
Oh, well, no. They're not the same. Sarsaparilla is a different drink, but they are made with kind of similar ingredients. So various plants can be used to produce that kind of round cola flavor and that little bit of licorice flavor. You know, both of these were made as a reaction to alcohol. So soft drinks, you just think about the word soft drinks, that's a reaction to hard drinks. So the whole idea was to provide something, an alternative, something that was as interesting and fun to drink as booze. We all know how well that worked, by the way. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with root beer, but it did not provide adequate competition to beer.
One of the things that's linked with booze is storytelling,
mm-hmm.
BS.
Yes,
and
nonsense.
As a student of the history of liquor and the stories that are found in it, it can be fun to find things that people have always taken to be true that are not true at all. I was curious if you found anything like that.
Oh, there are so many. Yeah, there are several in the book. One that made me particularly crazy, we were talking earlier about bourbon in Kentucky, and there's something that's very commonly said about the origins of bourbon. Any book on bourbon, any book on corn repeats this story that Thomas Jefferson himself... offered either 60 or 80 acres of land in Kentucky to anyone who would plant a field of corn, and thus bourbon was born. So the idea is, you know, a founding father invented bourbon, mandated that bourbon. And any time a founding father is involved, I get very suspicious. And so in this case, I contacted the Kentucky Historical Society, and they just geeked out on this question. And so it turns out, first of all, the Virginia Land Act, which is what settled Kentucky, even though it was in Virginia, the Virginia Land Act did not even happen while Thomas Jefferson was governor, so there's that. It wasn't even him. And, like, it wasn't 60 acres, it was 120 acres, and you didn't have to plant corn. You could also plant something else, or you could serve in the military, or you could do one of several different things. And they were just amazed to find out that this story had been circulating so long. So, yeah, I love being able to debunk things like that. The whole Benjamin Franklin saying beer is proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy, he totally never said that. I was just at a BevMo the other day, and they have it painted up on the wall. And I said, he didn't actually say that. He was writing a letter to someone, and it was actually about wine, and the actual quote, and the poor cashier, you know, his eyes just glaze over. I'm like, just give me a Sharpie. I'm just going to get up there and correct it.
So another thing I learned backstage is that you and your husband own a rare bookstore.
Yes.
And cocktail enthusiasts love cocktail books. Any cool ones cross your path?
Yeah, we really look for them. They are getting harder and harder to find because cocktail enthusiasts snap them up. But the wonderful thing about living in the age that we live in is that cocktail research gets very easy to do as things are being digitized. It's easier to get hold of really rare and unusual books. But the thing about booze is it's just one of those subject areas that people didn't really keep and preserve. These books were well used and well loved and splattered with, I don't even want to know what got splashed on them. They fall apart and they fall out of use. So sometimes it's even just a little pamphlet from a pharmaceutical supply company will pop up with some strange recipe in it. It'll give you one more clue to, well, what is the history of you know, cinchona bark in this particular formula. So it's fun to find that stuff. And yeah, we are always on the lookout for it, but so is everybody else.
I thought it was really interesting what you said about enough with the idea that if it was old, that older is better. And right. One thing I find so interesting about spirits is how much they try to trade on the idea that they always find some aspect of their story there's a building on the property that's 400 years old.
And, right.
And the spirit itself has only been made for been being made for 5 years.
Well, we love a story.
Yeah.
And in sales especially, it helps to have a good narrative. I mean, you know, why do we like Ben and Jerry's ice cream? I mean, it's great ice cream, but you kind of like the idea of these two old hippies in Birkenstocks making this, you know, in Vermont. So you like a story. But it is funny. There's especially this sort of European tradition of having sort of this myth, you know. Our recipe was given to the prince by his footman in gratitude because he saved his life, but then he drowned, and after that he got kidnapped, and he was in prison, and he met this other guy, and he gave the recipe to him, and and it's just so elaborate, and it's like, oh. I so wanted to fact check some of that stuff, too. There was one that involved Napoleon, and I happen to be very interested in Napoleon, and I was really trying to debunk it, but I just ran out of time. But what I love to see, though, is that here in the U.S., and I think especially on the West Coast, but actually kind of everywhere, the modern craft distillers are much less interested in having secret recipes and myths and silly little stories about lost princesses and towers, and much more interested in really talking about the ingredients and saying exactly what's in it. So, you know, our recipe is not a secret. There's these 12 plants, and we really want to talk about these plants because we're excited about them. So I think that's kind of cool. I interviewed this guy who grows sorghum in Indiana, and he makes something kind of like rum from sorghum molasses. You can't call it rum because it's not coming from sugarcane, but there's this Amish farmer, and that's the guy he gets it from. And he gets a letter from the farmer saying, you can come on Tuesday. And, you know, he can't call him. Like, he just has to show up on Tuesday to get it. And he says, everything in this bottle comes from this 3-acre plot. I can show it to you on Google Earth, and it's all about the ingredients. And to me, that's a much better story than some...
Yeah. Something else you touched on and kind of related is how liquor companies aren't required, unlike most food companies, right, aren't required to divulge ingredients. Why is that?
Isn't it funny? So the thing is, they're able to protect their formulas by basically what they have to do is they have to only include things that are approved food ingredients. So if you want to make gin, you don't have to say what's in the gin, but the gin can only include ingredients that come off a list that the FDA creates of what is okay to include in food. And right now, craft distillers are pushing at the FDA to expand that list. They're coming up with these obscure, interesting plants, and it's a challenge. There's a Douglas fir eau de vie, you know, being made up in Oregon, and I think that kind of blew their minds. You know, like, really, you're putting basically conifers into food? Can we do that? So you don't have to disclose your ingredients as long as it's an approved food ingredient. And that's how they get away with it. And there are some rules. If you really know how to read a liquor label, you'll know that if, for instance, if it says with natural flavors, well, that means flavors other than what the thing claims to be. So if it says blueberry vodka and then it says with natural flavors, that's your clue that no blueberries were harmed in the making of this vodka. They're natural, and that they're plant extracts done in a laboratory. But that's it. And same with if it says with artificial ingredients. That just means it's something that comes off a list of approved artificial ingredients.
Did you get to? I mean, as someone interested in science, did you try to get to the bottom of what's in some of these things?
Or? I did try to get to the bottom of some of these. There's no stopping you from taking a bottle and giving it to a scientist who can do a mass spec kind of analysis on it and basically reverse engineer it and figure out what's in it. That turns out to be harder to do than you would think, because different plants contain the same molecules. The exact same flavor molecules are found in wildly different plants. So lavender and lime peel contain an identical molecule. Vanilla beans and oak trees contain an identical vanilla flavor, which is why you get nice vanilla flavors from your oak barrels. So finding those signatures on a chemical analysis turns out to be harder than it sounds. So, yeah, I was all excited. I was like, I'm going to bust open this Angostura bitters question right now. We're going to answer this. I got a budget. I'm going to make it happen. But it turns out that stuff is a little bit complicated.
Yeah,
who knew?
It's so funny. You know there's garbage in there, but they protect it by acting as though it's some heralded, old, you know.
We don't know.
Authentic thing.
Yeah, we don't know.
You mentioned lavender. The sort of beginning moment of your book is that bottle of aviation gin,
uh-huh,
right, which features lavender. And you seem to mention lavender lovingly a few times throughout the book. Is that one of your favorites?
Well, I think lavender is great in drinks. You know, lavender is one of those things that you can't cook with much. You can do cookies or something, but for the most part, you don't eat it. But it's got this incredible floral fragrance that's in a class unto itself. And you use it like in gin, or, you know, you use it in a drink, often with gin or vodka, and you're mostly smelling it, right? Like, most of the experience of a drink is you're actually smelling, not tasting. And it's just one of the only times you can really get that pure, clean lavender flavor is by using it in a drink.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I do love it.
I love gin for that reason, too, and I think you talk about it really beautifully, that it suspends these, like, archetypal essences, like perfume, like you said, that we get to enjoy them. But with gin, it's like the base material of the spirit is almost secondary. I was curious what spirits you're into that feature more the agricultural product of the spirit itself was made from? Like, you talked about agave spirits in that way. Are there
right.
others?
Right, yeah. I mean, so agave spirits, there's no extra plants added to change the flavor. So if you're drinking tequila or mezcal, it's just crushed up agave plant. I mean, maybe they've smoked it in a different way or heated it in a different way, but that's all that's in there. You drink rum, and it's just sugarcane, crushed up sugarcane, boiled molasses. That's all it is. And I actually think rum is a great example of a spirit that is kind of undervalued and underappreciated. But boy, are there some extraordinary aged rums out there that are so full of flavor. I was at a blind tasting of spirits one time, and I did not get that it was rum. I don't know what I thought it was, but there was so much just chocolate and caramel and floral stuff going on, and it's just amazing that you get that out of nothing but sugarcane in an oak barrel.
Yeah, rum is an awesome category. It's so diverse.
It really is.
So many different flavors. I think it's my favorite. Actually, in talking about, we talked about bourbon, and sort of a hot issue in bourbon is GMO corn.
Uh-huh.
What are your thoughts, or what's your...
You know, my thing is so funny. I was so naive going into this. I thought, I am going to find out that these craft high-end distillers, like the star distillers of bourbon, are very particular about a variety of corn. And they've got it locked down, maybe an heirloom corn variety. And to a person, they all said, nope, we just buy number 2 Yellowfield corn. It just needs to be clean and dry and full of starch. That's all we care about. You can't taste the difference. But there are a few people making bourbons where they're using these heirloom varieties of corn, and you really do taste the difference in the bottle, which I think is so cool. But the GMO thing, it's a very big issue, you know, selling into the European market, getting GMO-free corn to make our spirits with. And organic as well turns out to be really tough. You can make great spirits out of organic grains because if you grow them organically, less nitrogen in the soil means less protein in the grain, which turns out to be good for fermenting and distilling. But organic grains are tough. There's a Square One vodka. They do a organic rye vodka. And most of the organic rye being produced is sold as cattle feed for organic cattle. Well, you can have bugs in your grains if you're feeding it to cattle. And she said, you know, we just kept getting grasshoppers in the rye. I mean, I'm not making grasshopper vodka. I'm making rye vodka. So it's just supply is the issue, getting enough of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
As it seems like you've done so much research and traveling, and I'm just dying to hear others. I guess maybe it's not true, but I imagine there were moments of tasting something in a certain location. I know for me, like being where something is made or looking around, and you're just struck by the beauty of spirit and being connected to what it's made from and where it's made. I mean, did you have moments like that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. But, you know, even here in the U.S., I mean, the amazing thing is we don't have to travel far.
Mm-hmm.
I think Clear Creek Distillery in Portland is, you know, an incredible example of just amazing fruit brandies. He does a blue plum brandy that just about turned us into Slivovitz alcoholics, you know. I mean, it was just like the greatest thing. And that's just something, you know, those are fruits that are grown in Oregon, and it's very local, and it's a very singular relationship with a farmer, and it's a fruit that only does well in that particular little region, and just amazing stuff. Yeah.
So what's next?
Oh, well, what's next book-wise?
Well, you're prolific. You've written... What, 5 books?
Six
books, sorry.
Yeah.
You wrote one in the last 10 minutes.
Right, I know, it's back there, yeah. My next book is actually a novel, so fiction this time. I stumbled into this story as I was working on Drunken Botanist that took me, really sidetracked me, and really fascinated me, but it's a story that's better told as fiction than nonfiction because there's not enough of it to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm working on it now. I'm actually going to go. I'm off to New York next week, and I'm going to talk to my editor. It's just about done. One more round, and so maybe next year it'll be out.
Do you ever drink while you write?
No, you know, no. I have to be very. My brain has to be very clear. It was a tough thing with Drunken Botanist because it'd be 2:00 in the afternoon, and I would have been writing about, you know, pastis all morning or something, and I'd be like, you know, I should probably run downstairs and. But we have, being self-employed, you need a rule. So we have a rule, no drinks before 6 in our house. And sometimes we're like this, 6:00. No, I had to be very well behaved, you know. I mean, moderation in all things. All this travel and research and stuff, I am surprisingly moderate drinker these days after having done all this work on this book.
Well, as we've discussed, there's a lot in the book about how spirits give you a sense of place and how tied to certain locations spirits are, which makes sense because they're grown. You're from Texas originally.
I am, yes.
And I was curious, how do people drink in Texas, or do you have family memories or experiences that...
When I grew up, people drank badly in Texas. Texas has come a long way, of course. A lot of Texas pride goes into some Texas spirits now. So I think things are getting better, and there are even some good Texas wines out there. But, you know, the 70s and the 80s, just about anywhere, were pretty rough drinking-wise. That was sort of a dark era. So I'm glad that's over.
No, bartending-wise, too.
Bartending-wise,
well, not that I bartended in the 70s.
No, but...
Or much of the 80s.
But, right.
Yeah, it was a lot of... It was dark ages, yeah.
A lot of pre-mixed stuff, and yeah.
What... I'm interested. You don't seem to have a vendetta against industrial production, which is sort of refreshing. I was curious to hear you talk more about that. That you don't see large brands as enemies of good spirits.
I was actually surprised. I think that is one of the surprising things about the liquor world, is that there are some very nice things made in very large quantity. And I'm glad to see people talking about this too, that there are some pretty terrible things being made in small quantities. Wayne Curtis in The Atlantic just did a little piece about tiny little craft distilleries making kind of not very good spirits. You know, I mean, it takes more than a Kickstarter campaign to make a great bottle of gin. But... So, yeah, I don't think that in this case, I don't know that small is always better, and I don't know that big is always terrible.
Wayne Curtis is a great writer. I loved his book about rum.
Yeah, he wrote a fantastic book on rum.
Any other books, booze-related books you recommend or that were helpful for you?
My prized possession is this two-volume, very academic thing about the chemistry of alcohol that has long sections that go plant by plant and get into the plant chemistry. Wiley published it, and it has a very boring name, like the two-volume compendium of the chemistry of alcohol or something like that. And it's like this crazy $700 thing to get, and I managed to get hold of one affordably. And no one else, like you and about four other people, would love this book. If I brought this in, you'd be like, I'm not even coming out on stage. I'm just going to sit back there and read this thing.
I want to see it.
Yeah, good stuff.
Let's go back to the audience. This is a question that we're both supposed to answer. If you're stuck at a dive bar, what basic well drink would you order? This is for both of you.
Yeah, that's a very good question. My answer would probably be a beer. If there was a decent beer, I would have the beer. Otherwise, it would be just a whiskey on the rocks. But my problem with that, and maybe you can tell me how much this really happens, is I swear I have been in dive bars and ordered like a whiskey that I've had plenty of times before. I know just what it tastes like, and I'm pretty sure that's not what it was. Does that happen that much?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that happens.
So, see?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That might be, actually, if you had to define dive bar,
it would be
an aspect
that
of the
is
definition.
The definition.
Yeah. I agree. I think we've been talking about it, but bourbon, if you took the difference between the worst bourbon and the best bourbon,
yeah.
I think of all spirits, that difference would be the least. Like, cheap bourbon can be pretty good. So I would order bourbon.
Uh-huh.
I have an anthropological interest as a bartender, so I like to see how people make different things, so I might order. I'll order a Manhattan often, just to kind of get an idea of how the place operates.
I'm worried about how long that bottle of vermouth has been opened.
And it's generally oxidized, but it's just because I'm interested.
Yeah.
You know, it's curious to see. And also, I think so quickly the quality of average bars is going up. Like more and more people are able to make the standards well. And
well, let me just say, my thing about bars is when you walk into a restaurant, you would never be presented with a wall just hung with a bunch of raw ingredients, like some dead chickens and some broccoli and whatever, and have people just say, what do you want? And you got to just look at all that and go, well, I don't know. Could you make me a stir fry? Like, that would never happen. But in bars, there's just all these bottles, and people are expected to know what to ask for. And they order terrible, you know, they order cranberry juice and vodka because they don't, how are they supposed to know what there is? And so I think the advent of nice little cocktail menus has been such a great thing, because you can get people focused on finding something good that, you know, they might order again and again. So it's nice to see that happening, even at divier bars.
I think that's really well described. We've reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question, and I have it in my hand.
Okay.
And I bet a lot of people have this question for you. What's your favorite drink and why?
Oh, right now I'll tell you exactly what it is. It is Coqui Americano, the Blanc, not the Rouge, mixed with dry rosé wine. I'm a big fan of dry rosés, and I just love Coqui. We can't even get it in Humboldt County. I order it by the case and have it shipped up. I think it's the greatest thing in the world.
Great.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of us are going to try it.
Yeah.
Our thanks to Amy Stewart, best-selling author of The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. We also want to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Thad Vogler, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.